Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Bernard Haich. He's an astrophysicist and author of The God Theory and more than 130 scientific publications, and that's probably even more now. And today we're interviewing him on his book, The Purpose-Guided Universe, Believing in Einstein, Darwin, and God. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Haich. I am very grateful that you, I guess you're up at 9 o'clock now, is that right?
That's right, it's not too bad.
Oh, that's not too bad. I interviewed a medical intuitive from Australia. She had to get up at 3 in the morning last night.
That would be a problem.
That would be a problem, especially to get up and do an interview.
Yeah.
I can't remember, did I interview you on the God Theory?
I think you did, yes. I don't remember exactly when, but I think you did.
I love that book. I really recommended that to a lot of people. I am very pleased that you wrote The Purpose-Guided Universe. You have brought up a number of really important points, and those of us who are trying to reconcile science with consciousness research and spirituality, I think that it's a very well-thought-out book that that I would highly recommend to our listeners. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself as an introduction, and then we'll get into some of the important points of the book?
Sure. My background is in astrophysics. I have a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Spent many years working on projects mainly funded by NASA, having to do with building spacecraft, or rather, research satellites and analyzing data from research satellites for NASA projects. I always wanted to be an astronomer from the time I can remember, from the time I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to do, so I did it in life, and that's kind of proud of that, because usually you don't get to do what you want to do.
That's true. It makes life a lot more fun when you're doing what you're guided to do in the purpose-guided universe.
Right.
Before
exactly.
We get into the book, I wanted to ask you, as especially since you have all your experience and knowledge in astronomy, have you had a chance to take a look at the alleged UFO over Mongolia?
I read the story on the web, but I looked at the video, and all I saw was some flashing lights, which could have been anything. So it was very, very unconvincing in terms of the video. There was nothing there.
Well, I wonder what the concerns were that caused them to shut down the airport, though.
I don't know really. I do not poo-poo the subject. I think there's something to it.
Mm-hmm.
At that particular case, I really had no visual evidence that was worthwhile to pursue. So I'm.
Right.
I saw
right.
it, but I didn't make much out of it.
Okay. Well, I just thought I'd ask because a lot of people are talking about that right now. You start out in the book about some tenets that actually are summarized at the end of the book, and I found them very interesting. Let's see, it's on page 207, and it's labeled the 10 critical properties of the universe.
Right.
And I love that you have dissected these out from science. And your particular field to show us that how if things had been just a little bit in one direction versus another direction, the universe and sentient life with sentient life on it may not have existed. Would you like to start there and kind of explain to our listeners how you came across these?
Sure. There's been evidence gathering for the last 20 years or so that some of the laws of nature and the constants of nature are really kind of life-friendly. That is, if they had different values, in some cases very slightly different values, we probably wouldn't have a universe in which you have stars forming, planets forming around stars, and thereby having conditions for life to originate and evolve the way it did on the Earth. So this is recognized as a problem in astrophysics that needs explaining. In fact, the new book by Hawking talks about this too. He's basically got the same data that he discusses. But of course, he draws a completely different conclusion than I do. His conclusion is that if these laws of nature are especially fine-tuned, that's got to mean that there are many, many other universes, probably an infinite number of other universes that are all pointless. And so it's all a matter of statistics.
They're all pointless.
Yeah, all pointless. Whereas I think that if this is true, that these fine-tunings make life possible, as it looks like they do, then that probably points to a great intelligence behind it all. It points to a purpose behind the universe, and hence the name, the Purpose-Guided Universe.
And you know what's so interesting, if you know anything about Stephen Hawking's medical condition, it's against all odds that he is even alive.
It is, yes, it is.
You know, and so that's quite a interesting thing that perhaps it's just a roll of the dice that he's alive. But he is. I mean, it makes you wonder why he doesn't understand miracles, as he is a living miracle. He really is. I mean, to a medical doctor, you know, that's, I mean, it's very interesting that he is the miracle, and yet that he is alive, and yet he doesn't believe in the whole realm that makes miracles possible.
Well, a lot of scientists, you know, dismiss anything spiritual. In fact, I would say the majority do not do that, because it just goes contrary to a worldview that you grew up with when you do science.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one that you can break things apart to understand how they function and what they're made of. And that's the way to come to a deeper understanding, by breaking things apart and looking at the basic processes. But I think you have to look very differently at this in the way of examining consciousness. I think consciousness is a different process than you know, what you find in a physics laboratory or a particle accelerator. And I don't think you'll ever find consciousness by looking for the molecules that cause it, because I don't think they do.
Well, exactly. The way I'd look at it, I've interviewed a lot of people on consciousness, and a lot of the theories, including the Irvin Laszlo's theories and the theories presented in the book Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, which actually goes through many, many of the different evolution of consciousness theory. The thing that strikes me is that the laws of the third dimensional world, which you in your book suggest that these laws are created and then just allowed to, you know, allowed to go on their own, which I agree with, because, I mean, how often do people defy the law of gravity or the other physical laws? It's rare. In fact, it's called a miracle when it happens. So we live in the world of third dimension, and science has to be cognizant of these laws and rules, as well as the inherent duality that is occurring in this third dimensional world that we call objective reality. But consciousness is beyond this world. It's not of this world. It may create the world, as you suggest, and many other people suggest, and I agree with that. But the laws by which you would study consciousness have nothing to do with our local laws in the universe, and that's why science fails to be able to study consciousness, in my mind.
Well, science has done a great job over the last three centuries of building a more, well, a healthier world, a more technologically savvy world. We've really improved things over the conditions that existed hundreds of years ago, thanks to science.
Right.
And that's led to the conclusion that science is the only way to make progress, the only way to advance our thinking. And I can understand that. You know, you can justify that argument, but unfortunately, I think it's going to run into a brick wall when it comes to understanding consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The efforts going on now to try to isolate consciousness as some kind of the emergent function, that the emergent thing that comes out of the brain, that's the approach that is assumed to be the only possible one that can have any success scientifically. And I think it's going to hit a brick wall eventually, because I just don't think that's the way it is.
Yeah, it's like putting the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Right.
It can't work like that. So basically, when we're looking at consciousness, as some of the I can't remember exactly. I think it was one of the authors that you quoted, as well as the religions that you quoted, some of the Eastern religions. Experience is actually so important in understanding consciousness, rather than theory, mathematics, and some of the other things that are, especially physics, is based on.
That's right, and I think that consciousness, and it's the experience of consciousness directly in transcendent experiences throughout the ages, I think that's real evidence. So I say in my book that, look, our universe looks like it's finely tuned for life, and that's, you know, that's something that needs to be explained, and there are two possible explanations, and in a sense they're equally defensible.
Mm-hmm.
One is the one that Hawking would make, and others who have published books on this, and that is that the universe looks special because there are many, many other universes, and so, of course, we're in the one that suits us because we couldn't exist anywhere else. But it's all a matter of statistics, and none of these universes have any purpose or point. The other explanation is, well, our universe looks special. It probably is, because there is probably an intelligence behind it. And so these two views are equally defensible, but yet I think there's a bit more evidence on my side, because the transcendent experiences that people have had throughout the ages give direct evidence that there is something different, that there's something different than our physical world that exists, that there is an intelligence out there that can be directly accessed. And I regard that as valid evidence. It's not, you know, it's not evidence that would stand up in a court of law or that would be subject to a scientific proof, but it's evidence nonetheless, and I take it seriously.
And you talk about the perennial philosophy that I think Aldous Huxley outlined is also part of this important understanding. Would you like to go through that for our listeners,
sure.
What that is?
Yeah, the perennial philosophy actually goes back a long way. It's really a distillation of human wisdom coming from the esoteric cores of all the world's religions. And it was nicely pulled together by Aldous Huxley, as you mentioned, in a book called The Perennial Philosophy, published in 1945. Let me read you some of the three key tenets of the perennial philosophy as I've discussed them in my book. The first one is, the physical universe of matter is not the sole reality. Other non-physical realities exist, which may contain other life forms. Interestingly, this is consistent with string theory and M theory at the forefront of modern physics. We can talk about that. Secondly, our human nature has both a material side, subject to physical laws, birth and death, as well as a non-material immortal spirit or soul. And third, all humans possess a capacity to intuitively perceive the true multifaceted nature of ourselves and the greater reality. And I comment, unfortunately, this is pretty dormant in modern society. So those are the three tenets, and you find that these at the core of all the world's great religions. But unfortunately, you also find that most people who adhere to a religion are unaware of these core principles and sort of get sidetracked by the paraphernalia and the dogma and the other things that that are touted as the substance of religion, which really don't matter at all.
Yeah, it's interesting that the world we live in is one inherently of duality, and in your book you point that out very well. In the current world we have all of this just the blossoming of information that used to be esoteric and basically within secret societies and the top echelons of religion that was the basis of the perennial philosophy. But in any case, at this point in time, we have all of these horrible, gruesome executions, beheadings. I think in your book you talk about Saudi Arabia, the number of beheadings every year, and that two journalists were beheaded because they suggested that a religion other than the Islam was should be looked at. We just have all of these really horrible things coming out of fundamental religion, and at the same time we have books such as yours and many of the other books that you mentioned in yours really bringing together a whole new understanding of spirituality and science.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of sad that the leaders of religions don't seem to know the basics. I mean, they're all wrapped up in their own particular brand of religion, and they don't really understand what I would say is the fundamental truth. And the examples
right.
you gave from Islam, really, the worst possible evolution of religion, the worst possible application of religion, to believe that whoever doesn't agree with you should be murdered or tortured or in some way, horrible things done. It's really awful that that's religion.
Not only that, but if you don't believe in a certain religion, you're going to be damned for all time.
Exactly.
And even beyond this life.
For all eternity.
That's
that
really
idea
hilarious.
That idea is so absurd. It is really so absurd. It reminds me of an incident when I was a kid. I was probably, I don't know, maybe 11, 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I was at a friend's house, having dinner. We had just a very modest dinner. We were having hot dogs, but they were really good hot dogs.
Uh-huh.
About halfway through that hot dog, I realized, oh, my God, it's Friday. And Friday, Catholics are not supposed to eat meat, at least they weren't back in those days. So there I was with my hamburger half-eaten, realizing that, oh, my God,
You're
I'm committing not just a venial sin, but a mortal sin.
A mortal sin.
And I might go to hell forever for eating that dang hot dog. I stopped eating the hot dog, I think. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure why. I may have eaten it, but I probably went to confession.
Well, maybe you could have just waved your hand over it, made it fish, and it would be okay.
Well, the question was, what do I do? Do I now stop eating the hot dog and tell my friend, well, I'm full, which would be a lie.
Right.
But remember, a lie is only a venial sin.
Right.
Whereas eating the hot dog was a mortal sin.
Well, I think you need to go ahead and go to confession and do, what is it, how many Hail Marys?
That's right, yeah, or maybe a rosary.
Do the rosary until you undo the sin.
Yeah.
I think that would be the easiest thing. Well, it is certainly an interesting world that we have created here, that a child feels so completely at odds with what to do because he's eating a hot dog.
It just goes to show what insane things people can believe, things that make no sense whatsoever, and yet, there are adults around were mm-hmm. back then who would say, well, yeah, that's how it is.
Mm-hmm. I want to take this opportunity to ask you a question kind of off the book because of your knowledge. I was reading a book called Alien Mind, The Thought and Behavior of Extraterrestrials by George Lobuno.
Hmm.
And in the book, have you heard of Tom Bearden's work?
I have heard of it, yes.
It's very interesting because Tom Bearden's work is reviewed in this book as part of what is explaining, as the aliens were explaining how they move, 100 million light years. So I decided to call up Tom Bearden last weekend and ask him if he'd ever heard of the book, and it's very interesting because he'd never read it. So I think now he's going to read it. Isn't that interesting? But in any case, there's something. I'm not going to talk about aliens. I'm going to talk about the physics in this book, which is
okay.
extremely interesting. And this is quoting from the book. Bearden's quick summary of electrogravity: when light waves converge from opposite directions along each of three different axes, so that opposing light waves along each axis cancel each other out, they bleed into electrogravity, a kind of artificial gravity, and then if you converge and cancel out electrogravity, it bleeds back into electromagnetism or light waves. Now, what's interesting about this is that just similar to how physics had to reframe things when they discovered dark matter and dark energy, if electrogravity is real, and it is actually how alien or ET or advanced being races bend space as to make these traveling of great distances possible, as is outlined in Alien Mind, wouldn't this be very important in the study of physics to understand that there's a whole other area of what we didn't even know about that might help explain the theory of everything?
Well, I don't really know how to comment on that because I don't know what he means by what you just read. So
okay,
yeah,
but isn't it
really
interesting? There may be a whole other, you know. I did the Caltech course on dark matter and dark energy, and when I read that, I mean, it really helped to explain a lot of things that that I was unsure of in terms of just studying regular physics. Would you like to? I mean, you talk about dark matter and dark energy in your book. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure, because it's very interesting that today there's about 5% of the universe that's made up of stuff that we know.
Mm-hmm.
The ordinary matter and the radiation that we studied as astronomers for years and years. About 70% of the universe is comprised of dark energy, as far as we know. But we don't know what dark energy is. All we know
right.
is it's an anti-gravitational force, sometimes equated with Einstein's cosmological constant, that is serving to accelerate the universe, to push it faster and faster in its expansion.
Mm-hmm.
This discovery came about only about 12 years ago. But what a mystery. 70% of the universe is made up of stuff that we don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And another 25% is dark matter, which is totally different because it's gravitational. Dark matter
mm-hmm.
is positively gravitational, so it attracts itself and attracts ordinary matter, and we don't know what it is. And so 95% of the universe is made up of stuff that we don't know. So we have quite a mystery on our hands.
There are a number of references to dark matter and dark energy in this book. Let's see. Basically, they talk about Johns Hopkins University, where I went to, and Space Telescope Science Institute photographed a dark matter ring around a galaxy cluster. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, I've seen something about that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the first visual evidence of the source and of the sort, and it suggests that dark energy and dark matter are structured collectively in a sense. So the space itself appears to hold a missing mass. So physicist Gordon Kane says dark energy is assumed to be the energy of the vacuum or empty space. And physicist Hong Ching Zhao thinks dark energy and dark matter may be two aspects of the same phenomena.
Well, that's odd because I wouldn't know how that could happen because they have the opposite effect. So the reference to dark energy being perhaps the related to the quantum vacuum, that's,
mm-hmm.
that's true. The quantum vacuum, sometimes known as a zero-point field, has some of the same properties as dark energy, but the problem is that there seems to be so much of it, theoretically, way, way, way too much of it, that it would be a major problem in explaining why the universe hasn't either collapsed or blown itself to pieces. So there's some deep connections here that are very suggestive, but we just at this point don't have enough evidence to know what it all means.
Now, in your book, you give the example that at the minute of the Big Bang, there may have been an almost equal amount of creation of matter and antimatter, except just a little bit more matter than the antimatter. Would you
like
to go through that? Because that's an interesting concept to me.
This is very important because you would expect that matter and antimatter would be formed in equal amounts during the Big Bang. There's no reason to think there's any symmetry. And yet, it turns out there were 30 million and one particles of matter for every 30 million particles of antimatter. And it's really important because that means that there's some leftover matter, which, of course, is critical for our being here because that's what stars and planets and ourselves are made of, is ordinary matter.
Right.
So the question is, why was there this imbalance of one over the other? That's one of these key properties of the universe. And I would argue, well, and maybe that's because this is necessary to have a universe friendly to life, and maybe that's what this intelligence had in mind. That would be my first-order explanation of it, along with the 10 or 9 other properties of the universe that you alluded to that are really special and that require some kind of explanation, either one in terms of multiverses that have infinite numbers of universes in them, or one that is like ours, made perhaps for the benefit of life to originate and evolve. By the way, I want to make clear that the theory I'm proposing in my books has nothing to do with intelligent design. It's a very different theory. I'm not talking about any kind of a god who microengineers life forms.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I say in my theory that evolution is really critical. It's a necessary part of the purpose behind the universe, in my opinion.
Well, that goes along with the idea that the laws of the universe are created by consciousness and then allowed to roll along and unfold.
Exactly, because if they weren't allowed to run along and unfold, you'd have something that's sort of a pre-planned show, a puppet show, a play, something that would have very little interest, I think, for a creator, because it would simply be something not original, something that was not of any great interest. I think novelty and originality are the two things that are really the objective, to have experience happen to us beings here in this universe. So the intelligence that made this universe and made us, and I think who actually is living in the universe through us, can experience what reality feels like, what it tastes like, what it smells like, what it is. And to have that happen, you need to have spontaneity and novelty. And that means, in my opinion, evolution.
And let's talk a little bit about the theme you just brought in, that there really is nothing other than primary consciousness working through not just humans, but all of life forms in this universe, other universes if they exist. You bring out in your book that it is not necessary to believe in other universes. You know, they may or may not exist. There's equal evidence for both ways. But consciousness is coming through everything, including probably inanimate objects as well, and it's only the amount of light that gets through that then creates the situation called enlightenment. That's why it's called enlightenment, because whenever somebody becomes enlightened, there's a great deal of light involved. You want to explain that a little bit?
Well, I'm not sure about the light involved in enlightenment. It may be just a bit of semantics.
Well, they see the light. I mean, humans.
Yeah.
Humans see the light. That's pretty, almost everybody who describes the experience.
That's right.
There's a lot of light. Okay.
That's right. There's a lot of light in the transcendent experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way that Sir James Jeans, about 80 years ago, he was a famous British astrophysicist. He wrote about the nature of the universe. And he wrote that the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine.
I love that.
That's really a great quote, because I think that really summarizes my perspective on the universe, that this whole thing is a great thought. Now, by a great thought, you might think that I'm trying to trivialize it, you know, a thought. Well, what's a thought? It's a transient thing. It has no substance. But a great thought by a great intelligence manifesting in a universe, with laws of the universe being what they are, so that life can evolve and so that this consciousness can enter into the life forms and experience reality, that's a great thought. And
it
I think
is.
That that it's that perspective on reality that we're going to discover this century is necessary to understand consciousness itself.
And it also helps explain this system that you're outlining in your book, which I really think is great, a great theory to explain the evidence. This thought that many people have written books about this. Why does evil exist? I mean, that's really a very, very interesting question to people who are trying to explain the nature of God.
That's the type.
Why did God allow evil to exist? And I think you do a very good job in your book of addressing that.
Yeah, that's really the tough question. People ask, well, what about the Holocaust? You know, you can't explain that away in some touchy-feely way about, well, it's just a difficult thing to explain. But I do think we can get some grasp on it. And it comes about because of two things. One is you need to have opposites in a universe of experience. You cannot have any kind of experience without opposites. And so you have to create a world of polarity, hot, cold, light versus darkness, and so on. You couldn't see anything if there were no light and darkness separated from each other.
Right.
So in the same way, you need a certain amount of good and not good.
Mm-hmm.
That not good could be, for example, look at our cells. We are beings composed of cells. How many cells die each day in our body? Millions of cells die every day in our body.
Yeah.
Is that bad? No, not for bad for the cells, but not for us, because it keeps us alive.
Mm-hmm.
So you need good versus not good. And then you add to that free will, which makes the whole thing worthwhile. And free will plus the good versus not good polarity, it opens the gate to all sorts of pernicious evil that humans can engage in, and perhaps other beings too. But I think it's those two things, that the polarity and the free will, that are kind of like a loaded gun that, you know, will allow some people, for whatever reason, to abuse it and to take things and misuse them. And I think that's the best handle I can have on this perennial problem of why there is evil.
And the other thing that I think is important for us to understand is that these laws that are put in place by the great thought, consciousness thinking the laws into existence, these laws, although they do have byproducts like evil and evil deeds done by, you know, whatever, I mean, the consciousness that comes through, they also allow us not always to know what is going to happen next. Because if you think about it, if you are all-knowing, and there are masters who've walked the earth that are all-knowing, they know what's going to happen next. I mean, they don't worry about it because they see into the future using, you know, different techniques that probably exist because they can take their consciousness outside of space and time and view other time-space continuums. But in any case, if you were all-knowing as masters have been, there would be no surprises. There would be no ability for you to do one thing and not really know what the consequences were until they came down.
Yeah, I think
a learning environment, in other words.
That's right. I think we can't know everything here. In fact, if we did, it wouldn't be any good.
Well, we
wouldn't
learn anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have these unknowns in order to, well, what would happen if I did this or if I thought that, you know, because we're learning more and more that our thoughts, because we are that we are, you know, the I am that I am idea, that the portion of us that exists outside of space and time is connected very much to the consciousness that pervades all things, that we are, you know, able to create in like that our thoughts create. So there you have it. You know, if our thoughts create, then the world becomes a very, very different place.
And you better
have some control over your thoughts. You
that's
better not just every time somebody pulls that in front of you and cuts you off, you know, have murderous intents toward them.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea.
Well, I think the Dalai Lama is a good example of someone who's a master. I mean, I regard him very highly. I quote him, in fact, in my book.
Uh-huh.
But I also don't get the feeling that he knows everything. I mean, he seems to be very much a human being. But
right. I'm not saying all masters do. I'm saying there were masters who walked the earth that did, you know, that were, like Jesus knew what was coming down. I mean, there's evidence of that in the story of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he made certain predictions that then became true. So he obviously knew what was coming up in a way that wasn't, you know, all that pleasant for him if you read the story.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm not saying all masters know, but I think that there were great people that are some of the avatars that have, at least when I study their stories, it seems that they know quite a bit about what's happening. They're able to survive assassination attempts and all sorts of other things because of this knowledge. So it's just interesting. But I do think that they have a way to go beyond the third dimensional box that we're in to view other things outside of it.
Well, I think we all have that ability in principle. Now, I don't do it myself. I try to meditate, and I don't have that much luck with it. You know, my knowledge is mainly intellectual rather than experiential. Mm-hmm. But I do think in principle we all have access to universal knowledge, because I think we share the same consciousness as the Creator. It's the
right.
same stuff. It's like, you know, it's like a little match versus a bonfire, but the same flame. And then the idea is to try to see whether that can be accessed. And it's accessing
yeah.
that during one's lifetime that sometimes mm-hmm. results in this transcendent experience that I think provides the evidence that there's more to reality than simply the atoms and molecules and the four forces of nature that we study in physics.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, it's just like when you describe the experiments that show in quantum physics how important it is that the observer observe in order to create the outcome. And maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But the idea is that when you're observing in the third dimension, you are subject to the rules of the third dimension, which mean that time is linear, you know, space, you can't be in two places at one time, that kind of thing. But yet when you observe in, because consciousness can go wherever. I mean, consciousness is not present. Its source is not in the third dimension. So if you go backward, or not backward, but upward through dimensions toward the source of consciousness, you can see more than, the laws change. You know, in the fourth and fifth and sixth dimensions, the laws are different. That's all, I mean, they're just different rules. And like, for example, in the fifth dimension, many of the metaphysical teachers tell us that it isn't a duality. So the rules are totally different. And that's what I mean, that's what I'm studying, is the different dimensional awarenesses and how we can access them. And it is very experiential. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what I would say to people, don't believe what I say or what other people say that have done this. Just go do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the ideas in M theory, which is the forefront subject in physics today, trying to understand the theory of everything or to evolve into a theory of everything, they talk about other dimensions, too. In fact, other dimensions are an essential part of the map. The whole theory doesn't work if you don't have other dimensions. And in those other dimensions, there's a possibility that you can have other universes. Other universes, why not have other intelligent beings?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between that kind of a cosmology and one that you find in the spiritual traditions that talk about the different dimensionalities? I get suspicious when people talk about, well, dimension 5 is this and dimension 6 lets you do that. I don't buy that. I don't think anybody knows the details that well. But the idea that there are multi-dimensions and that we're only part of a greater multi-dimensional reality, it's just,
mm-hmm.
just kind of both curious and almost amusing sometimes to think that same idea comes out of both M-theory and the spiritual traditions of the world.
Well, not only do they have the same type of theory, they actually predict the same number of dimensions.
Hmm.
The number is the same. It's 23 that collapses into 9, I think.
Well, I think in M-theory...
Even the collapsing part of it is the same, that it collapsed soon after the creation of this universe. It's just interesting that people of antiquity have the same theory now that M-theory is playing around with mathematics. I interviewed Maku Kichu at one point on the string theory on this radio show. So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's always interesting.
Yeah.
Michio Kaku?
Michio Kaku, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Wrong pronunciation. It was many years ago. I think it was in the mid-90s. I've been doing this radio show for 16 years, so I've had a chance to interview many, many of the physicists.
I'll bet.
Yeah, and it's been very good. I mean, my personal interest is in consciousness, and I studied, you know, all of the ancient philosophies, and then compared them against what the modern physicists were finding. And so it's almost like, how did the ancients know what is now predicted in 20th and 21st century physics? And the conclusion I came to, and it's a theory, you know, there's some evidence for the theory, is that the gods of the Old Testament, which you quote in your book, the Deuteronomy quotes in here, which were very good, you know, that if you find your wife is not a virgin, she should be stoned to death, that kind of thing. Those gods were not actually God. They were more ETs or advanced, not so advanced beings, but more advanced in technology. And so the Old Testament really doesn't have anything that is useful about understanding the consciousness, the God consciousness that you talk about in the purpose-guided universe. It was only when Jesus came in and then redefined everything that that idea of God came forth. And then so did Buddha and you know, other leaders of different religions. They came in to reframe the, you know, the multi-God theory, which, you know, in there would probably be, that would be who told Noah to write the ark. To build the ark would be someone who could see that seven asteroids were headed toward the planet.
Well, I don't know if I would be that believing in that. I mean, I think that there's really a dark side of the human imagination. I think a lot of that can account for the things you find in the Old Testament. It's the human imagination that produced these things.
True, but there's also other evidence that show that there's technologies involved in antiquity that could not have existed. And evolution of things like the Sumerian mathematics and off-world astronomy maps that couldn't exist without that little component of extraterrestrial intervention. So, I mean, I've studied all of that. I've interviewed the authors on the book. So it's not just theory. It's actually a great deal of evidence to that effect. But if you put it all together, it does make sense that in the world, in the world of antiquity, we had a potential for really not understanding the God concept as the until the masters came forth and reintroduced the idea that actually each one of us is a portion of this consciousness. And then the religion started fighting among each other and created the world we're in today.
Yeah, the mess we're in today.
Yeah, really. Would you like to talk a little bit about evolution? You have a chapter in here on evolution, and what do you think we're evolving toward?
Well, that's a good question. I think that I think we're evolving both spiritually and physically. Now, physical evolution is a very slow process, and I fully accept the evolutionary findings of science, leading us back to the Earth forming 4.6 billion years ago, and everything happening since then to lead to life. And when I talk about the universe being friendly to life and being designed so that life can originate and evolve, I don't mean to imply in any way that we were the ultimate objective of it. I think that we could have wound up being very different beings than we are. But the objective of the universe, I think, is to evolve life forms to higher and higher levels, not necessarily like us, but we, you know, just having us be an example of that. So there's no claim that we are the ultimate goal of it. In fact, I would doubt that we're anywhere near the top of the hierarchy in terms of evolution of life forms in this universe, because there are many, many, many stars in our universe, most of which probably have planets, and many of which will have life forming on those planets.
And
so I think evolution is
much older than we are, too. I mean,
that's right. In fact, I think that our sun is somewhere slightly on the young side in terms of the population of stars that we're among in our corner of the galaxy. So if we do find other life forms out there, they are liable to be more advanced than we are, because we're a little bit younger than the average star in this vicinity. That's a very interesting finding.
Well, in the book Alien Mind, the author talks about two major hurdles that populations have to get over, according to aliens that have lifespans of 11 million years, according to him. And the two hurdles are interesting. The first one is the discovery of electrogravity, which we were talking about earlier. And electrogravity, if misused, will cause your star to burn out a lot quicker. And he says so many populations discover electrogravity, which we have not yet, except, I guess, Colonel Bearden knows about it. But in any case, the discovery of electrogravity and the either misuse or avoidance of misuse of it is a very important step in young civilizations. He said the second most important thing, which is very interesting, is the leap from sexual to asexual reproduction. So the more advanced cultures do not have sexual reproduction. They have asexual reproduction, and thereby limit their population and also probably increase the quality of the what is produced, because obviously when you're growing things in a test tube or, well, in a lab or whatever, you can make the conditions ideal rather than have the baby in the womb of a cocaine addict and then all of the subsequent problems that occur from that. So the book Alien Mind is very fascinating in this idea that we are a very, very young culture. We haven't even discovered electrogravity yet, and the author was talking with one of these aliens, and he made some comment about something he didn't approve that was done, and the elder alien said to him, he said, "Well, what is your plan for limiting the population of Earth?" Which is interesting, because the population out of control leads to all sorts of really serious problems, including potential global warming and even threatening the planet itself.
Hmm.
So it's a very interesting book. I suggest you might take a look at it.
Well, I'm curious where you got his information. You know, I'm very skeptical of this sort of thing because, well, just in general, I am.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was a major in the Air Force, and as such, I was privy to a lot of information and a lot of direct experience with people who had direct experience with things like the Roswell aliens. And, of course, Wright Pat was the place everything was taken to, and I was stationed there for 4 years. So, again, it's experience. You know, I have met people who actually saw the live aliens. I have sat alert for many times where the F-15s were scrambled to investigate UFOs. So, and there was a recent disclosure by many of the military people about UFO activity around our silos just, I think, last week. I also know Edgar Mitchell, who is a former astronaut who has disclosed quite a bit. And so, again, it becomes personal experience. I have no reason to disbelieve what these people are telling me. And since they're in the military and have telling me certain things that they have proof of, I have no reason to disbelieve them.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the fact that, you know, we may be very close to a disclosure, in which case the proof will be presented worldwide.
Well, that would be a very interesting time. I mean, I certainly hope if that happens that I'm still alive to see it, because that would be so world-changing. It would be the most exciting thing in human history.
It would be.
But, you know, it could be another 100 years before it happens.
It could be. But anyway, the information in Alien Mind, given that you take the information as what he says it is, and it is a faith-based thing for that amount of it. But in general, I think it would be the Disclosure Project would be a very, very important piece of the puzzle to advance humanity spiritually, because it would force us to then become more responsible. I mean, do you see that?
Oh, yeah,
knowing that we are part of a larger, more intelligent, more technologically advanced community would maybe help us become more responsible globally.
It might do that, but of course it would also generate all sorts of undesirable consequences, because I used
like
to think that the world is, you know, we're sort of ready for this. We're advanced enough scientifically to understand that there could be other beings out there. And yet I look at the craziness going on today where people can't even be tolerant of each other, much less, I think how crazy some of the fanatics in the fundamentalist religions would be if confronted with what they would call demons, you know, which is what
they would
call it.
They would call demons, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. But still, the decision to disclose this information is probably not going to come from world governments, if you know what I mean, because they're not organized enough. I mean, even the UN does not appear to be organized enough to make that decision. I believe the decision for disclosure will come actually from the people disclosing themselves to us. Does that make sense? They have.
You mean the other intelligences?
Right. Exactly.
Sure. I mean, if they exist and if they're visiting us, then obviously they could any time manifest and have something hovering over a city for enough length of time that the world's news services would be on the job and wouldn't be able to deny it and just make fun of it and apply the giggle factor to it.
Right, exactly. Well, in any case, it's an interesting possibility in our future, and I think it would be a major step in the spiritual evolution of humanity.
Right, because it would let us understand our basic nature. And right now, we're confused about our basic nature, and that's the source of a huge amount of the world's mm-hmm. problems. We think we're just bags of chemicals.
Right.
That's what science is telling us anyway. There's no purpose and no point to our lives. And once we die, we're gone. It's all just a matter of physics, and it's a pretty bleak perspective on things.
It also leads to a lot of crimes, because if that's true, there's no consequences to your actions.
Sure, sure. You can get away with what you can get away with. You know, well,
right.
Good for you, because take what you can get while you can get it, because it'll be over with soon enough.
And then when you die, there's nothing there, so, you know, you don't have to atone for anything. You don't have to reincarnate, come back, and pay for your sins, you know.
Exactly.
It's a total egocentrical view of the world. I mean, that's like at one end of the spectrum. And then at the other end of the spectrum is, you know, the ideas of reincarnation, karma, and the spiritual evolution, whereby we come back, you know, maybe 1,000 lifetimes here in order to evolve to the point where we have humility and compassion and patience and responsibility. You know,
even Carl Sagan pointed to that as the something worth investigating. Now, he didn't believe it. He came out against the
mm-hmm.
reincarnation. But in fact, in his demon-haunted world, he actually says some positive things about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read you what he says about that. He says, at the time of writing, there are three claims in the ESP field, which, in my opinion, deserves serious study. One, that by thought alone, humans can, barely, affect random number generators in computers. Two, that people under mild sensory deprivation can receive thoughts or images projected at them. And three, and this is the one I'm referring to, that young children sometimes report the details of a previous life, which upon checking turn out to be accurate, which they could not have known about in any way other than reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I pick these claims not because I think they're likely to be valid, as I don't, as examples of contentions that might be true. So even Carl Sagan was open to the possibility, and I know who he's referring to. He's referring primarily to the work of Ian Stevenson,
mm-hmm.
University of Virginia professor who spent about 40 years or more doing really, really careful field studies of
right.
children who remember past lives. And so it impressed Carl Sagan, and it impresses me, and I think we have a lot to learn in this regard.
Well, I interviewed Paul von Bord on his book Science and Reincarnation, in which he presents that and some other scientific evidence. But again, I'm going to go back to the experiential importance. When not everybody is ready for reincarnation theory. They're just not ready for it because their lessons are here in the present, and they need to be focused here in the present in the third dimension because that's where the lessons occur. But if you look at somebody like the Dalai Lama, are you familiar with how they choose the Dalai Lama?
Somewhat, yeah.
That he has to go into a room with all these objects, and he has to pick out, I think, 12 or 15
yep.
objects.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Well, obviously, the majority of people involved in religious belief on the planet believe in reincarnation. I mean, there are probably more people because of, you know, just the numbers that accept reincarnation versus don't accept reincarnation that believe in religion. And I'm taking out the atheists and the agnostics. So I would say that when you are ready to understand reincarnation, you will have spontaneous memories of past lives and how they relate to this life that can be checked scientifically and verified. And that's what's happened to the majority of people that I know that are actually ready for that. And so, and then some people want to explore it, and they do past life regressions, and they may or may not be able to get information that can be scientifically verified from that. But, but essentially, not everybody is ready for reincarnation ideas because not everybody is ready to really accept the spiritual information that we truly are responsible for what we do. I mean, just because you don't pay for it in this lifetime doesn't mean that you won't pay for it in another.
And if you think about it, what sense does it make to believe that you live one life and then you're judged forever after, to go heaven or hell based on this one lifetime? With all the differences that we...
Hot dog on a Friday.
Hot dog on a Friday.
And didn't go to confession.
Yeah. Or all the, the great vast disparity between the lives that we're confronted with, you know.
Yeah.
The ultimate free lunch would be a baby that's born and gets baptized after a week and then chokes on her pacifier at week two
right.
and goes straight to heaven. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't. Well, do you have any more books in the works right now?
I'm thinking about some new books. I thought when I wrote the first book, The God Theory, well, this is it. I put everything
in
30 years.
That's all it is.
Yeah, this is everything I know. It turns out, well, I guess I knew a little bit more than that, so I started the second book. And I'm serving that same stage now. Pardon me?
You two are evolving.
Evolving, right.
Now than you did when you read The God Theory.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm at the same stage again now. We'll see.
Well, I hope you do, and I hope to have you back on. We've been interviewing Dr. Bernard Heisch. Is that how you pronounce it?
Heisch.
His book, The Purpose Guided Universe. We had interviewed him before on his book, The God Theory, and are very pleased that he has made this information public because he has a lot to bring to the whole consciousness arena. And has written a great book for people trying to reconcile science and spirituality. Join us next week for an interview with Catherine Frombrevich, who wrote a book called Our Chemical Lives and the Hijacking of Our DNA. Very interesting book on the world we live in now, which was very, very different than even the world our parents lived in. And then Stephanie Marone will be back on the 23rd with Natural Medicine First Aid Remedies. And on the 30th, I'm interviewing John James on his book, The Great Field. We have at Noetic Science Meeting, you may remember that Edgar Mitchell developed Noetic Science, I think probably after his cosmic consciousness experience on the way to the moon. And we've been having Noetic Science meetings at the Atlanta Community Group ever since 1996. We will have our next meeting on Thursday, October 21st at 7:15 p.m. Our guest speaker will be Ed Edwards, and he will be doing an energy demonstration. He was tested at the Rhine Research Center, and he is able to increase light level or photons by 210 times the amount of normal background photons. This would be an example of that light that we were talking about being able to come through a human and being scientifically verifiable. So Ed is currently being studied by several universities, and he will actually do a live demonstration of this energy that comes through him. And that will be on October 21st at 7:15 p.m. We also have a Millennium Healthcare Wellness event monthly, and if you check our newsletter, that's all in the newsletter. Again, thank you very much, Bernard, for joining us. I really enjoyed our interview, and we will be back next week with Temple of Health Radio Show.
Thank you very much.